Blog Talk Radio. Thank you. Sabotage of the West. The West has lost its standards, its sense of truth and falsity, good and evil. So anything goes. In the meantime, no disagreement can be settled because the two sides are too far apart. For example, what compromise exists between those who desire regular growth, economic growth, and those who see any capitalism as a series of continuous attacks against the planet? Again, how can any détente exist between those who believe in traditional Western European marriage and those who claim that all white men are satanic abusers? One more. How can anyone take seriously a man who cheated his way into the White House, who is morally bankrupted, who's utterly idiotic and clueless, and needed to be impeached not only before he entered office, but really before he was born? Anyone who takes seriously the notion that immigration can have deadly consequences must be silenced, including those alarmed at city streets in Paris shut down daily by prayer rug carrying believers. The attacks in Sweden, Germany, France, Belgium, and in any other place are meaningless next to the need to treat every foreigner as a precious living segment in the great chain of being. God creates all equal value and must be instantly applied without hesitation to all persons. How can the West survive an undertaking if marriage means nothing? How can the West survive as an undertaking if marriage means nothing unless it's simply a symbol to enfranchise gays? If children suffer from a lack of a father, that's a small price to pay to help free the planet from patriarchal stupidity, moral blindness, and hatred of anyone not like them. And freeing children from repressive traditional families, we free the government, the only real vehicle of enlightenment in history, to take over the care, feeding, clothing, and especially education of these ignorant child masses. Only through this can mankind hope to evolve into personkind, away from personhood or mankind, and the selfish and parochial statism can be set aside for a beautiful new world of globalism where all are equal and protected under the benevolent eye of the magnified world state. Good morning, Kelly O'Connell, 608. Ran into some stories over the weekend, and these stories led me to believe that the West is in peril and that the basically, the people that are running things right now have gotten so crazy in the Ivy League and all these other places. They've gone off the reservation so far, so long ago, so deeply that we've got to fight our way back if we hope to make it. But I was really wondering over the weekend, reading some of this stuff, you know, what are the chances that our country, our society makes it, the West makes it, if we have all of these internal, basically these internal attacks that are basically suicide attacks, that they don't care what happens as long as the past is, you know, the people in the past who did all the wrong things are punished, including white people. I'm thinking, I don't think a culture that is totally opposed to white people, a Western society, European society, can make it. It just, you know, it's what you're doing. No, what nobody talks about is people in the present are being punished for what they're parents and grandparents and great-grandparents supposedly did. And I just don't, you know, I mean, it's obviously it's kind of a dumb idea to begin with, but I just don't see how we're going to be successful if this is what we stand for. Nobody is standing up, or the right people are not standing up. And you've got an attack on free speech that's coming out of Wellesley, perhaps the most celebrated female college out there. So let me get you, though, a clip from the Facebook Live killer. You heard about that, the guy that killed somebody on Facebook and said there's 15 more.
We have complete team coverage of this deadly Easter Day shooting with a deeper look at who the shooter is. Also, reaction from the victim's family. But first, our Derek Waller brings us the latest on the manhunt happening right now. Derek?
Well, Rob, police across Northeast Ohio have been looking for Stevens all night, and here's why. On that live Facebook video, he claims to have killed 13 other people, but tonight there is no indication that that claim is indeed true. We have a picture of the actual car that police are still looking for right now. It's a white 2016 Ford Fusion with Ohio temporary tags E363630. That's an extremely common vehicle, and tips have been pouring into police all night with potential sightings. Air Tracker 5 has been up all night tracking the search. At one point, police found a car matching that description on East 105th near St. Clair, but that was a false call. Other reported sightings all across the county, including in Solon, downtown Cleveland, the city's west side, and Chesterland, but they are still looking tonight.
But we need to bring this to a conclusion today. We need to get Steve off the streets, give Mr. Goodwin's family some closure, and then, you know, people later on can dive into exactly why this happened.
And Cleveland Police Chief Calvin Williams telling us tonight that his crews are doubled up for their safety tonight, and they're working with neighboring departments all across the area, including other local police departments, the State Highway Patrol, and the FBI.
Here's a little more on that guy.
Our Tara Molina did some digging. She brings us more on the man behind today's Facebook Live killing. Tara?
Well, Ron, honestly, this just adds to an already incredibly disturbing story here today. But this man had absolutely no criminal record, zero history with Cleveland police, no run-ins with the law. But his activity on social media before that horrific shooting does say a lot.
That is what Steve Stevens had to say for himself, minutes before parking his car, approaching an innocent elderly man, shooting and killing him. Thinking it through, he laughs.
Massacring.
His only concern? Proving to people watching him that he is capable of murder.
Like, man, I just always been a monster, man.
But has he? Before his monstrous acts this afternoon, Steve Stevens wasn't on the radar for Cleveland police. Zero criminal history. He works with children at Beachbrook Behavioral Health in Cleveland.
I'm a case manager for Beachbrook. I'm killing with my Beachbrook badge on, too.
Beachbrook staff won't tell us how long he's worked there or exactly what he does, but a spokesperson says they're shocked. Quote, "We are shocked and horrified like everyone else. To think that one of our employees could do this is awful." Now removed by site operators, featured videos of him in shooting ranges, posts tying him to local churches and organizations, and status updates like this one, published just hours before this, detailing financial problems. He claims to have lost everything at local casinos, and says he's reached a breaking point. In the video, consistently bringing up a breakup.
You know, I was living over there with her. I just woke up Friday. I just couldn't take it no more, man. I just left. And, here I am.
Stevens names his ex-girlfriend in the video and even blames her.
Wow. Lucky she didn't get taken out. 6:15, we'll take a break and come back and talk about the theme of the show, which is whether the West is trying to destroy itself. 6:15, Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, and 805-61804, your text line. We're going to come back and talk about this theme with a few examples for you. Hope you had a great Easter. Got a little Al Green for you, the Rev. All right, some headlines for you before we dig into this story. Facebook killer shoots someone on live TV, or live Facebook, I should say, and says he snapped, claims to have murdered 15 others, but they say unlikely. North Korea missile launch is a total dud. It blows up, and so they want to know, did the U.S. hack into the system there and cause it to self-destruct? Kim Jong-un, the fat little kid who runs North Korea, is said to be ready to kidnap tourists if attacked, claims one defector. Trump is ready to strike nuclear sites. What do you think about that? Big mistake. And is Trump having to deal with the failures of the previous administration, or is this all of his own creation? South Korea and United States Air Force holding a joint exercise. China, Russia send ships. Hawaii preps for attack. And Pope, the famously Marxist Pope on Easter, is says it's important to cling to faith amid wars and hatred. And Dick Van Dyke from all those great Disney movies is claiming it's time to get rid of all the violence on the screen. Yeah, all right. So here, let me just play a little bit for you here. I'll just explain to you what happened. A lady came to give a speech at Wellesley College, which is one of these kind of classic old Ivy League schools. And the women there went ape feces and demanded that she lose her job at another Ivy League school. So they've also changed the First Amendment in this Wellesley so that any person who is using what they call hate speech can be shut down and even physically attacked. Real crazy stuff. Here's a little bit about this story.
I posted an article by Jonathan Chait entitled, "What the Charges Against Laura Kipnis Tell Us About Political Correctness." As Chait writes, Kipnis wrote an article for the Chronicle of Higher Education protesting what she saw as her school's excessive regulation of sexual conduct, specifically the prohibition of university professors sleeping with their own students. Students angry with her petitioned the school administration to issue official condemnations of Professor Kipnis, and two female grad students filed Title IX charges against her, alleging that the article and a tweet she posted related to it amounted to retaliation against those who had different opinions from Kipnis, ironically enough. I do personally think some of the new policies aimed at tackling a very real problem are staggering overcorrections, and it's interesting that some of the more authoritarian sectors of the left oppose government small enough to fit in the human body, but seem quite content with it being large enough to fit in a dorm room.
So anyway, this lady goes and she offends these people. Now, they're not only going after this lady, they want her fired from her school, which is Northwestern, but they also want the woman who brought her to the campus at Wellesley. They want these people to be, this lady to be removed as well. And so it's just, I don't know. It's just so crazy. Yeah, I mean, we've all seen this stuff, and we know that it's dangerous. But at the same time, you know, I mean, I these people, these junior snowflakes, these social justice warriors, are going to be running this country because the country, the leadership of this country is taken from the Ivy League, for better or worse. And so, you know, if you've looked like I have at some of these pictures, some of these protests, it seems to be all minorities. And what I'm wondering is, and they refuse to admit, they refuse to explain how they choose people who come into their schools. But it's obvious to me that they're using these Ivy League schools as laboratories to breed a new kind of American who hates sexism and racism and is anti-capitalist and pro-socialist and is in favor of all of the stuff that a lot of people see as leading to the demise of the culture. These are the people that are going to be put into leadership. So here's a little bit from this lady, Laura Kipnis.
I want things that offend me to have power over me. I want to have power over them, which I think means having intellectual distance and using my intellect as a distancing tool. You know, to paraphrase Nietzsche, who said things that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I think that what doesn't offend me makes me stronger, or what does offend me and I'm able to overcome the offense makes me stronger. So I just don't think that I have to succumb to what offends me. I would rather use my intellect as my own form of weapon.
That's a nice little introduction to the lady. Seems to be a fairly, I don't know what you would call her, but her ideas on students dating professors is probably alarming to some people. But here's a little bit from Kipnis on how campus feminism infantilizes women.
Writing with some concern about what now gets labeled feminism on campuses, which has to do with, I think, dialing back a lot of progress women in particular have made about establishing ourselves as consenting adults.
Laura Kipnis is a professor of communications at Northwestern University and author most recently of Men, an Ongoing Investigation, in which she asked the perhaps subversive question of what do men want. Laura Kipnis, thank you for joining Reason TV.
Hi.
We will talk about your book in a second, but let's first talk about your perhaps unlikely new role as poster child of the anti-campus political correctness movement. Earlier this year, you write an essay about sexual paranoia in academia for Chronicles of Higher Education, in which you criticize the sort of administrative changes, regulatory and even social changes at the University at Northwestern as regards sexual assault and just sexism in general. And then the reaction goes bananas. There are protests, and eventually even two students filed a Title IX complaint against the words that you wrote, yes, saying that it was somehow going to stifle, a chilling effect on their lives here. When this all happened, the reaction, did you at least have a chance to pause and high-five yourself for having your theory proved correct, or did it go straight to the Kafkaesque nightmare?
Well, I should go back a bit and say that I was writing in this article as a feminist, and I was writing with some concern about what now gets labeled feminism on campuses, which has to do with, I think, dialing back a lot of progress women in particular have made about establishing ourselves as consenting adults. So a lot of the impetus of these new campus codes is to take consent away from women and students and put it in the hands of administrators. So I was, you know, writing against this wave of new regulation, particularly the codes governing professors and students dating. So what happened then was students staged this protest carrying mattresses and pillows and carrying a petition to the president's office. But the whole thing is that the mattress had become a symbol at Columbia, as everyone knows, having to do with student-on-student sexual assault. And I had written nothing on that subject. So when I first saw this photo of students carrying mattresses, I was kind of befuddled because it did seem symbolically incoherent to me. But I also did think, I'm not sure I quite high-fived myself, but I did think this wasn't going to end up looking good for the students. So I think that proved to be true.
Did it kind of suggest to you that maybe the problem in the way that we talk about it and our changing rules is worse than you thought?
It did prove what I had said. I thought, you know, more than I could have imagined, because by carrying this petition to the president's office asking for me to be censured for having written an article, you know, asking the administration to protect them from you know, what I can only think is a kind of very slight umbrage of somebody having written something that they don't agree with. I mean, yes, it did prove one of the points I was making, which was that this increase in these codes and regulations is increasing students' own sense of vulnerability, so that everything becomes an injury. And the question I asked was, how does this leave them after graduation to cope with, you know, what happens out in the world where there aren't administrators to protect us from, you know, minor injuries?
So anyway, that's a little bit from her. Let's get some local news for you right here. 523-1450 to call in, 805-6180 to text. But got some more on universities attempting to turn the First Amendment into a protection device, and even suggesting that physical attacks against those who you disagree with are an acceptable part of the First Amendment.
It's a natural fact that I want to come back. Show me where it is.
So, the sorry, I was just kind of going over this article for you. The title, Wellesley College Students' Hostility is Warranted Against Any People Who Say Things That Are Offensive. The editorial staff, and this is April 14th, so this is a couple days ago, and this is from The Federalist. The editorial staff of Wellesley College student newspaper recently wrote that anyone who dares utter a politically incorrect thought should be met with, quote, hostility. And it goes on to state that one of the statements from the article, if people are given the resources to learn and either continue to speak hate speech or refuse to adapt their beliefs, then hostility may be warranted. And of course, if people don't say the right things, then you're allowed to attack them. In March, six professors at the Liberal Arts College asked that the school rescind or take back invitations to controversial speakers because they are worried that the invited speakers' ideas might upset some of the students and, in a sense, take away their freedom. The professors wrote in an email, there is no doubt that the speakers in question impose on the liberty of students, staff, and faculty at Wellesley. They impose an attack against the ideas and the rights to not be infringed upon their minds, their beliefs. So this weird interpretation of free speech, that saying offensive or politically incorrect things deprives others of rights, is not exclusive to that faculty. Here's the student editors of the paper also said the spirit of free speech is to protect the suppressed, not a free-for-all where anything is acceptable, no matter how hateful and damaging. So anyway, obviously, in these kind of situations, these people are putting forward a proposition, which is basically that not being offended is more important than free speech, or their ideas are more important than free speech, or that their ideas are truth, and to go against truth has to be censored because it's an attack against the freedom to stay away from lies and oppression and everything. However you want to put it, there's no doubt that political correctness to force people to change their minds or to be silenced. Now, this coming from a bigger article from Andrew Mikta called The Deconstruction of the West, and he's saying that the problems of the West are not external. They're not from jihadists or Russia or China, North Korea. No, the biggest dangers to our culture is from the inside. We're doing it to ourselves. We'll take a break and come back and pick up that theme. 638 Kelly O'Connell AM Las Cruces. By the way, I want to tell you about something when I come back that I ran into that I want to play for you sometime this week that I thought was really wild, but I'll tell you about it. 638-523-1450 and 805-63. I'm blanking on the text machine. You know the number. We'll be right back on AM Las Cruces. The theme here is, or the idea here that I'm putting across, my belief, which I think is transparently obvious, is that these attacks against free speech, which represent the core of our identity, the ability to have freedom and liberty, but especially in our ideas and in our conversations, if you take that away and you allow one group of people, let's say the students of Wellesley or Harvard or Yale or any other school, if you allow this small band of persons to come up and decide for the entire society what is true, what is false, what is real, what is an illusion, what is real news, what is fake news, what is an acceptable statement of belief or an unacceptable attack against others. If you let a small group of people who come out of a very perverse situation to make those decisions, then it's a total disaster. And what's the difference between that and a religion? Let's just say if Islam took over and said, you can only be outside during these hours, all women have to be covered up, nobody can have a cross or a Bible, nobody can mention the word Jesus, you know, and all these different ideas that are associated with different types of tyranny. All right, here is from this article. And if you want to go to the Real Clear Politics website, it's on there. And just looking for it, I'll find the name of it for you in a minute. But I just want to get to this thing. What we're talking about is a collapse of society in values. So I'll just give you an example. If you live in a city that doesn't have a very strong economy, the people need jobs for themselves, for their children. The leadership of the city gets up and says the number one danger in the world is not lack of growth of the economy. It's global warming. Or it's racism. Fill in the blank. But let's just say it's global warming. In the city, leaders say, well, we're a no-growth area because we have to show the rest of the world what it's like to have no growth so we can go against and stop global warming. So you've got a situation where people are totally confused. The poor people may not be terribly interested in global warming, but they know they need jobs. The wealthier people, some might be in favor of capitalism because they've worked in it and they know that it's an engine for, you know, evolving and growing the community. Other people, other capitalists, other, you know, maybe not capitalists, but other members of the upper class might feel extremely strong about global warming, but there is a basic disagreement over what the society is supposed to be doing. And I would say that is an accurate description of where we're at generally as a society. We don't know what it means to be married anymore. We don't know what the purpose of sex. I'm just throwing this out as not even my opinion, but I think there's a broad disagreement as to why we have sex, or what marriage is, or what a family is, for example. That's just one example. Another example, we have a disagreement over the purpose of mankind. Is it to, as the good book says, to be productive and creative to create an economy to take over the world, to tame the world, and to have more children? Or is the purpose of human existence to care for the planet? So you've got these like deep issues at odds in the society, and it makes people it confuses them, I think, but it also causes them to a certain extent ambivalent about getting involved in some of these debates. And they look at these type of arguments that are happening at places like Wellesley and they think it's absolutely insane. And then they realize the entire school system has been taken over by this. And the Ivy League and really all of the universities in America have been affected by this. And you've got leadership by teachers, people in their 30s, their 40s, 50s, 60s that are driving this forward. And if you took these ideas and applied them to the society as a whole, it would cause gigantic destruction. So here's getting to this article. The problem that we're having right now is not external, it's internal. The problem rather is, and I'm quoting from this guy, the West's growing inability to agree on how it should be defined as a civilization. At the core of the deepening dysfunction in the West is the self-induced deconstruction of Western culture, and with it the glue that for two centuries kept Europe and the United States at the center of the international system. The nation state has been arguably the most enduring and successful idea that Western culture has produced. It offers a recipe to achieve security, economic growth, and individual freedom at levels unmatched in human history. The concept of a historically anchored and territorially defined national homeland, having absorbed the principles of liberal democracy, the right to private property, and liberty bound by the rule of law, has been the core building block of the West's global success and of whatever order that has ever existed in the so-called international order. Since 1945, it has been the most successful Western export across the globe, with the surge of decolonization driven by quintessentially American precepts of the right to self-determination of people, a testimony to its enduring appeal. Though challenged by fascism, Nazism and communism, the West emerged victorious, for when confronted with existential danger, it defaulted to shared, deeply held values and the fervent belief that what its culture and heritage represented were worth fighting for and, if necessary, even dying for to preserve. The West prevailed then because it was confident that on balance it offered the best set of ideas, values, and principles for others to emulate. Today, in the wake of decades of group identity politics and the attendant deconstruction of our heritage through academia, the media, and popular culture, this conviction in the uniqueness of the West is only a pale shadow of what it was a mere half century ago. It has been replaced by elite narratives substituting shame for pride and indifference to one's own heritage for patriotism. After decades of Gramsci's proverbial long march through the educational cultural institutions, in other words, the Frankfurt School, Western societies have been changed in ways that make social mobilization around the shared idea of a nation increasingly problematic. This ideological hollowing out of the West has been accompanied by a surge in confident and revanchist nationalism in other parts of the world, as well as religiously inspired totalitarianism. All right. I know that's very dense stuff, but worth thinking about. So if our society is being torn apart by this leftism that has come through the universities and the upper part of the left, the Democrat, the political class, through the media, think of all the crazy ideas that have come in and been established now in the last 10 or 20 years. It's destroying our culture. It's tearing things to shreds. What can we do about it? Let's talk about it when we come back. 649 AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450, and 805 6180 2 text. All right. So what can we do about this loss of freedom, really, intellectual freedom? Nobody can say anything that offends people. I mean, that's a crazy idea to begin with, but here's a little bit on free speech. I think free speech is the cornerstone. I was reading a book over the weekend that said that religious liberty after the Lutheran Revolution, or Martin Luther's Revolution, I should say, became the foundation for every other right. And I think that free speech as an expression of freedom of religion or vice versa is at the core to the answer of what's going on. But here's a little bit from Does Free Speech Offend You? PragerU.
Freedom of speech, the ability to express yourself, it's a cherished idea, as well it should be. Most of us who live in liberal Western democracies think of it as a basic human right. People have fought and died for it. But now we may be in danger of losing it. The threat is not coming from without, from external enemies, but from within. A generation is being raised not to believe in freedom of speech, but rather that they should have freedom from speech.
All right, so what do you think about that? My machine just crashed and burned, but see if I can get this going again. You know, the thing is that if we don't stand up for it, even in our small community, even around the people that are people that we interact with, I think we need to stand up when people try to bully us and just, you know, nonviolently give our opinion. Here's a little more from this clip.
This is a threat to both pluralism and democracy itself. We see this in Europe, where sensitivity-based censorship attempts to ban anything deemed hateful or even just hurtful, and to ban criticism of religion, especially Islam. But the United States, despite its strong constitutional protections in the Bill of Rights, is far from immune from the rising trend of suppression of speech, or what is sometimes called political correctness. This is especially true at America's colleges and universities, the place where our future leaders are educated and where you'd expect speech to be the most free. Highly restrictive speech codes are now the norm on campus, not the exception. According to a study by my organization, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, 54% of public universities and 59% of private universities impose politically correct speech codes on their students. And thanks to recent Department of Education guidelines, 100% of colleges may adopt speech codes in the coming years. How bad is it? At a public campus in California on Constitution Day in 2013, a student who also happens to be a decorated military veteran was told he could not hand out copies of the Constitution to his fellow students. The objection from the university was not ideological. It was out of control bureaucracy imposing limits on speech. That same day, another college student in that same state was told he could not protest NSA surveillance outside of a tiny free speech zone, an area that comprised only 1.37% of the campus. Months later, college students in Hawaii were told both they could not hand out the Constitution to their fellow students and that they could not protest NSA policies outside the school's free speech zone. FIRE took these colleges to court, but the fact that we had to shows you how bad it has become. Recently, students and sympathetic faculty have joined forces to exclude campus speakers whose opinions they dislike. At FIRE, we call this disinvitation season, although the season lasts all year round. Since 2009, there has been a major uptick in the push by students and faculty to get speakers they dislike disinvited. These speakers have included former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, the Somali-born feminist and critic of Islam Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and the director of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde. And that's only the obvious part of the disinvitation problem. Few conservative speakers are invited to speak at colleges lest they have to be disinvited later. The newest threat to speech comes from so-called trigger warnings. alerts that warn students that they are about to read or hear something that triggers a negative emotional response. A 2014 New York Times article cited the example of a Rutgers student requesting trigger warnings for the classic American novel The Great Gatsby because it, quote, possesses a variety of scenes that reference abusive, misogynistic violence, unquote. Recently, Oberlin College attempted to institute a policy that heavily encouraged the faculty to avoid difficult topics and to employ trigger warnings as a means of making classrooms safer. Safety has been watered down to essentially mean the right to always feel comfortable. New demands for trigger warnings are popping up on campuses across the country. Add in popular academic theories that encourage students to scrutinize speech for microaggressions, any statement that might be construed as racially insensitive, classist, sexist, or otherwise un-PC, clear that campuses are teaching students to police what they say. This is precisely the opposite of what is needed. Our society needs candor, and it needs freedom of speech, not freedom from speech. Intellectual comfort is not a right, nor should it ever be. Not if we want freedom of speech, let's just call it freedom, to survive.
All right. Take a break on the hour. Come back. Stand up for your rights, friends. 6:59 a.m. Las Cruces, AM 1450-523, 1450-8056, 1-800 to text. We'll be back to talk about more. Marriage is coming apart at the seams. We're going to talk about that next as another example of what we're talking about. You guys have your where's your watering hole?
Well, you go to his whenever he wins an election, or whenever there's a Democratic election party for victory, or whatever you call that, he's there. He's there with Democrats, and we're with the Republicans, I hope. And I'm already working on people to start volunteering and see if we can't come up with something beneficial for the county.
Oh, wait a second. Where did you meet this guy? You met him immediately after his victory, which is years ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know. Ken and I have known each other. I met his father many years ago. During the time that Reuben Smith was our first elected mayor, I'd met Ken. He'd come back. He'd come from the county, and he was coming over to become a city councilman here in Las Cruces. And then we met, and we stayed. We gradually got to know each other over the past 15, almost 20 years. And he's just a great guy. You know, he really, really is. And I see him to be governor someday, Kelly. I really do, you know. And I think he'll do a better job than Susanna, and I'm Republican, okay? So, you know, people love him. He's got some issues. He's got a few issues, but he's got a very compassionate skill.
What,
you know?
What are his issues?
We didn't go into that. I just don't agree with him on everything that he decides, like raising taxes and these kind of things. But, you know, he's still going to do better than a lot of other Democrats that have been in office, you know. So
he's middle of the road.
No, I would say so. He's a little above conventional, I would say. I haven't seen how he lives, but I would say he's above conventional. So that's upper class.
Well, sounds like you've been really hobnobbing. Anything else?
I love you, Kelly. I love you. That's it.
Have a good day, Bob. Thanks for the call. Bye-bye. All right. Not really sure what that was about. But anyway, here is – well, let's take a break, and we'll come back, and I want to play something that David Horowitz said so we can kind of understand what we're dealing with. 716 AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450, and 8056 180. You're listening to KOBE with Kelly O'Connell and Al Green. Oh, my goodness. but a sex symbol before he became a pastor. And you want to find out how he became a pastor, how he became converted. Of course, he came out of the church, was influenced by people like and people like that, Sam Cooke. Anyway, Al Green was a real, I guess you'd say womanizer, I don't know, typical rock and roll R&B person probably. He had an affair with a lady. The lady was married to somebody else, and she kept asking him when they could, you know, when they could get married and everything. And I guess she didn't like his answer because she came to his house and he was in the bathtub and she made a pot of grits and she came in and poured these scalding grits on his chest or just on top of him. And then went and got his gun and killed herself. So he had a come to Jesus moment after that. And then he ended up becoming a pastor. 717, 718 on the money. Be right back.
Love and happiness. Yeah. Something that can make you do wrong, make you do right. Yeah. Love. I haven't talked about any specifics yet. I think he's like in this stage right now and like probably planning a wedding. So I think we're all commercializing our lives right now and like we'll probably get it in the actual thing. But I can see why he pushed the wedding up because he maybe I don't know where we're going. They're going on honeymoon. It has not been announced yet where they're honeymoon. He's got short slippers. But my favorite new song dropped yet. Saturday night.
All right. So I do wonder, it does make me wonder, do Bob and the mayor hang out a lot? Sounds like a good person to influence the mayor, doesn't it? All right. So I was going to tell you something that I had run into. There is this guy by the name of Dale Watson. He's a country singer that I had gotten into quite a while ago. And I got this video. It's a movie. You can get it on Amazon, and it's about his life and career, and then the death of his girlfriend. And he had, he'd been married, and then he and his wife went their separate ways, and he had ended up meeting this attorney in Texas, and they had started this romance, and then she had gotten in a car wreck and died. And then so he was deeply affected by this for years, and I had listened to about half this story, and it was conventional. It's kind of boring. And over the weekend, I decided to listen to the rest of it. And I listened to the rest of it. I could not believe what it contained, which was a story of, it's one of the craziest things that I've ever heard. And I was just wondering if you wanted me to play it for you. Just a clip from it, but it was guy becoming very, very desperate and very emotional and really going to the nth degree to try to contact this lady after she had died. And he ended up using a Ouija board. And then according to him, and this is interesting, it's shot, about half of this is shot in New Mexico in a little town, and I'd have to do some research to find out where it was, but it's a very small town, like basically a ghost town. And Dale Watson went out to spend time with this guy that filmed this thing. And Dale Watson is just sitting there on the porch of this house explaining about how he basically had a nervous breakdown. But not only that, but there was a religious element to it too. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I had to go back and listen to it again, but it was very, very, very entertaining and very weird. But I thought you might enjoy it as well. Let me get to a few more headlines for you. And this is from Google News. Everything is Google these days. Mike Pence telling North Korea not to test American resolve, offering Syria and Afghanistan strikes as examples. Manhunt after the Facebook murderer. Let's see. 1,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons go on hunger strike. Not a lot of huge news, I would say. Looking for anything that you might. All right, so here is a little bit from David Horowitz. To set the table, what are we dealing with here? We're dealing with, in this culture, the fight, the things that are going on at Wellesley and Harvard and Yale and all these places, these Ivy League schools where there's protests, where you're not allowed to say things that offend people, where the speech code has been inverted. It's not freedom of speech. It's freedom from speech. It's all rooted in Marxism, and Marxism that has been brought into the academy, into Hollywood, into the upper echelons of the political class, into the mainstream media, and has taken over and devastated the intellectual life of America, and also is in the midst of tearing the social fabric in America from limb to limb. Here's a little from David Horowitz. I played this before, but it was so exceptional. I want to play it again. This is what we're dealing with, folks.
Can break down what's happening. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Alex. It is a disease. The left is a crypto-religious movement or a religious cult. And by left, I include the Democratic Party, progressives. They have all these names that hide what they actually are. But they believe the world is a fallen place, although they wouldn't use such an expression. It's a place of oppression, hierarchy, domination, and so forth. and they believe in a redemption. But the redemption is going to be carried out by them instead of a divinity. True religions understand that we're the problem. It's people that are the problem, and therefore you really can't fix it. And that's why, you know, conservatives are prone to a kind of fatalistic view. Things are probably going to get worse. And that handicaps them in this battle. But for the left, there's this promised land. I'm afraid the Jews are responsible for this idea. There's this promised land, which used to be called communism or socialism, but now it's called social justice, where all their dreams are going to be fulfilled. So if you understand that they're a religious cult, you will also understand that they see themselves as the army of the saints, and they see the rest of us, those who don't go along with their program, as the party of the devil.
And I mean, in fact, that's what they say. It's just wild. So Rachel Maddow, college professors, they're all in the priesthood.
That's right. And they see, that's what they talk like hellfire and damnation preachers all the time. That's why the Democrats are so effective politically. Everything they say is a moral indictment. Republicans talk like accountants. It doesn't motivate people as powerfully as the left's vision does, and it doesn't kill their enemies the way the left's resort to, calling you a racist, sexist, homophobe, deplorable. The Democratic Party is a party of hate. It runs on hate all the time, and that it sort of glues up their minds. So when they see Islam, they see people of color because they're racists. The term people of color is a racist term. We don't speak that way in English. There they are.
So it's cult programming, exactly. So where are they now? What's happening to them worldwide? Why are they like tripling their viciousness?
Well, because they see that Trump is a serious threat. Brexit is a threat. You know, they like governments which are completely unresponsive to the people, because the people are the problem. That's why they put so many people in the gulag and shoot so many people when they get the power, because they have a program to reach.
Exactly. Their religion has reduced the Earth's population. David Rockefeller, Bill Gates, they're the high priest of all this. And their final secret, I guess, that you learn in the cult, is people are the problem, kill everybody.
Well, that's the end game. But along the way, people are the problem because they don't go along with their socialist ideas. This is the problem. They got defeated in the election. They can't accept that. So they call it a resistance. And this is true.
And you predicted 20 plus years ago exactly what would happen in the future, because now I've read most of your books. Then tell us, looking forward, Mr. Horowitz, what's going to happen in the future if we don't really take action, and what we should do to stop these people, because they're clearly bloodthirsty authoritarians.
All right, so that's it right there. That's it in a nutshell. Here's your local news and 523-1450 and 805-6180 KOBE AM Las Cruces. All right, so MGTOW, men going their own way. MGTOW has been a big deal. There's a movement away from marriage, and as to why, you can speculate, but here is Dr. Helen Smith giving her take on it. Men need to boycott marriage.
Where is Mr. Rice? Well, ladies, he may be hard to find because men are apparently going on strike, boycotting marriage, among many other things.
According to a recent study, the importance of marriage has gone up for the women, up to 37%, and down for men to 29%. Here to explain the trend is forensic psychologist and author of the controversial book, Men on Strike. Dr. Helen Smith is here this morning. Doctor, nice to see you this morning.
Nice to see you. Thank you for having me on.
We were having a bit of a discussion about this last weekend.
I saw that.
Show, and the argument is what? That men simply are giving up hope on marriage because they're feeling beaten down?
No, I don't think they're giving up on hope on marriage. I think what they're doing is they're looking at it, the cost reward. Men look at things in terms of cost analysis, and the penalties for marriage are so high and the rewards now are so low. First of all, there's legal costs of marriage. There are so many men now who are just saying, you know what, it's just not worth it to me. I'm going to be stuck paying the alimony. I'm going to be stuck paying for child support. And it's not just legal reasons. It's also psychological ones where men feel that basically they don't really have rights in marriage. Women hold all the cards now in reproduction and all kinds of things, and men don't.
Well, that's all true. I mean, I agree with that completely. But it still doesn't absolve men of the responsibility to stop complaining about how the cards are against them. And man up and become men, because you don't become a man until you assume responsibility.
What man would take such a raw deal? I don't consider that a man.
Well, it's not a raw deal. You derive deep satisfaction as a man by taking responsibility for other people. That's the only place you get deep satisfaction.
So men are supposed to take a really bad deal and sign their rights away, and you call that a good deal. Look, you would understand economic rewards.
Well, I did.
You did. Well, that's good, and maybe you have a really good wife, but a lot of men don't feel that way.
But Doctor, here's where I get confused. And forgive me, I just went to a wedding last night, so I'm feeling all loved up.
Euphoric.
Very, yeah. Very, because it was beautiful. And any time that you do see a wedding, that the hope is renewed, and it does remind you of what's great about marriage. And so you act as though marriage is such a raw deal for men, but you do get companionship, and you get love, and you get a family. And I see men enjoying all of that and embracing all of that.
That's a different topic. Those are also things that you can get with a relationship. We're talking about the legal aspect of marriage. I'm talking about the political and the legal ramifications of marriage, where men aren't getting such a good deal there. And there are thousands of men across the country that I've spoken to and that will tell you differently. And the statistics are bearing that out. A lot of men, you think men need to man up, but to man up, you have to be getting something out of that relationship. What you're saying is that men are getting something just by having a woman. They're
Here's the thing. They're allowed. The one thing I agree with you on is men are getting away with having children without marrying the woman.
They're not getting away with it. What's happening is a lot of women, number one, don't want them. The lower level women, what's happening is 40% of the women who are breadwinners, a lot of those lower level women are making $17,000 to $23,000. Those women use the government to pay for themselves. They don't want a man. So rather than men are just opting.
Why hasn't a man written this book?
Because men can't speak up. I'm here to speak up because people will actually listen to a woman. It's really unfortunate. I want the next man, and I'm hoping by this book that next man is out there.
I want to say something as a man, because this always is frustrating me when I see commercials when men sort of speak up. They're acting like men, right? And all these commercials are out there where the man's like the lazy guy on the couch.
But look what the culture is doing to the men. Culture is telling men, you are no good. You are no good in marriage. You are no good. Even you all are hearing here. Saying man up to men, and that's a really negative message to be sending to men.
But what do you think the solution is?
The solution is for us to have fair laws and things for men, and to also these commercials, we need to look at the culture and say, you know what, quit treating men like trash. Seriously, we treat men very poorly in this society, from all the way from men who don't want to go to college anymore because there are many things in college that go on. It is a female-dominated place where men are not treated in a way that is fair. It's easy to sit here and say as high-level men and women that things are going well for you, but I've seen many men who are average, lower, and even higher level men who aren't having such a good time.
Yeah.
And if you read my book, you might understand a little bit more about.
The book is called Men on Strike. It is compelling, and I think you make a compelling argument.
An awful lot of people are reading your book, yeah. By the way.
We'd love to hear what you all have to say.
All right, 7:38, and I'll give you your weather here. What do you think about that, though? Men, in this case, young men refusing to get married. And there is a MGTOW movement, which I had mentioned before, men going their own way. Men who are refusing to get involved with women, they refuse to date. They're not romantically involved with anybody, and they're planning on not getting married. They're just going to live out their lives. And you know what? They're not gay. 7:39 a.m. Las Cruces, 523-1450 and 805-61802. Text. We'll be back to talk a little bit more about this phenomenon that I think is indirectly related to the shift in values.
Someone's on the phone, 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah.
talking about how she can make it right. Yeah. Yeah.
Here's the theory that the left, Marxism, couldn't make it because the people didn't, the workers, the people didn't get up and throw their chains off. And so the Marxists got together and they said, we, you know, still believe in this, but we got to find another way to deliver our product. The Frankfurt School comes together. This is incredible if you think about this. These guys are like the 12 apostles going out and spreading the gospel, but they're spreading the gospel of Marxism. And so what Marxism does, Marxism has no set core of beliefs except that there's a class war between human beings, and to get rid of the class war, we have to basically give all the money to the government, but so the government owns everything, there's nothing to fight over anymore. And in the meantime, and that's communism, but socialism is the intermediate step. That's what they're going towards. Everything else is in flux. I mean, you'll have super ultra pacifist organizations in the United States, and Obama was supposedly a representative of these. When communism gets established, it's the most warlike nations in history because they believe they have to go and take the world over to establish utopia. Anyway. Here is MGTOW Generation, Men Going Their Own Way. And this is, trying to remember this guy's, he works with Alex Jones.
Keeping up on women. And
John Paul Watson or whatever his name is.
Out of society. They're calling it the Sexodus. An entire generation of boys abandoning female company, relinquishing relationships, and retreating into a virtual reality world of pornography, video games, lad culture, and chemical addictions. Anecdotally, the flip side of the equation also appears to be true. How often do you hear women who have resisted the brainwashing of radical feminism bemoaning the fact that they can no longer find real men? Men who are actually confident enough to know how to act around women without being constantly terrified that every word they utter, every behavior they express, every opinion they espouse may be taken as offensive, sexist, or predatory. In part one of a series of articles on the Sexodus, Breitbart's Milo Yiannopoulos notes how an entire generation of young people are being left behind in the wreckage of the social engineering project known as third wave feminism. Yiannopoulos spoke to Jack Rivlin, editor of over 30 student newspapers, who told him of the increasingly troubling trend of young men on campus being completely clueless and scared when it comes to how to engage with women. What's to blame for this breakdown? The hysterical propaganda surrounding so-called rape culture, exemplified by the recent Rolling Stone University of Virginia scandal, plays a major role, as does its consequences. Mandatory consent classes and California's onerous and confusing yes means yes law, where students, in whatever state of inebriation, need to secure a kind of arbitrary verbal contract with each other before they can engage in any kind of sexual activity. The deadening of young boys' naturally rambunctious behavior via ADHD drugs such as Ritalin, as well as their educational abandonment, is also creating a generation of dysfunctional and reclusive adolescents devoid of all self-esteem, miserable and unable to relate to the opposite sex. The discrepancy between what women say they want and what they actually want also serves to confuse young men further. Men are constantly told they should be delicate, sensitive fellow travelers on the feminist path, writes Yiannopoulos. But the same women who say they want a nice, unthreatening boyfriend go home and swoon over simple-minded, giant-chested, testosterone-saturated hunks in Game of Thrones. Men know this, and for some, this giant inconsistency makes the whole game look too much like hard work. Why bother trying to work out what a woman wants when you can play sports, masturbate, or just play video games from the comfort of your own bedroom. The divorce process is also set up to grossly favor women over men, leaving many men frightened for fear of losing everything. Women are also becoming less and less interested in monogamy, claiming the player mantle so often ascribed to men for themselves as some twisted form of sexual equality. Are Western men, in increasing numbers, at risk of turning into Japan's herbivores, men who shun sex and prefer to go on long walks rather than flirt with girls? Is it any surprise that many men are turning to infamous pickup artists like Julian Blanc in a desperate last-ditch effort to reclaim their confidence around women?
All right, so that's the claim that men are walking away from marriage for a host of reasons. What are they? Number one, that men don't have the status that they used to have in society anymore, that women have risen up and have actually taken over men's status in a lot of venues, a lot of places. Number two, the divorce rate is much higher. Number three, laws have changed for no-fault divorce so that anybody can get out at any time. Think about this one fact. In terms of marriage, marriage used to be this training ground for people's character that, you know, anybody who's married long enough is going to have some long-term disagreements and is going to have to, before divorce was easy, people had to work out these differences. And through that, you learned how to, you know, not give up. You learned how to be dedicated to take care of what's yours. And in this culture, when people having problems with their spouse get together, what they're faced with all these options. Well, what's more, what's more attractive? Working through your problems, which might take years and a lot of unpleasantness and humbling yourself and having to change for somebody else, or just bailing and just finding another person. But I mean, the more people give up on intimate relationships, the easier it is. And the divorce rate doesn't go down after the first divorce. It actually goes up, believe it or not. We'll take a break and come back and finish this topic. 523-1450. I understand that Frankie called into Mark Levin. It sounded like him, according to one of the texters. And then he introduced himself as Francis from New Mexico. You can call in to Levin. Call in here, Frankie. You know, put a voice behind your insult. 750 AM Las Cruces, 523-1450, 805-6180 to text.
Happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. There's nothing wrong being in love with someone, yeah.
So there is now supposed to, and Frankie did admit to calling into Mark Levin, which I'm sure must have been something else. So all right. Well, just kind of wrapping this thing up, you could go on all day, but the fact of the matter is that there's a destruction in, and this is why I think that there is a general sense of malaise and to a certain extent indifference or depression in the society, is that people can't get their basic needs met because they're not in the proper relationships to get their needs met, you know? And we've developed a transactional or an instrumental culture where there is no friendships. You're just around people as long as they meet your needs. And when they don't, you bail. But, you know, it's setting people up for frustration. And all right, so here is a little clip for anybody who's here illegally, and I'll tell this to my clients. Homeland Security John Kelly, you could get deported with one DUI.
There seems to be another definition in this administration. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say that the definition of criminal has not changed, but where on the spectrum of criminality we operate has changed.
So can you give me an example of somebody that wasn't deported before that you're deporting now?
Well, someone, as an example, multiple DUIs, even a single DUI, depending on other aspects, would get you into the system. And remember, for the most...
And this wouldn't have been the case under the previous administration.
But you had to remember that there's a system, a legal justice system in place, and the law deports people. Secretary Kelly doesn't, ICE doesn't. It's the United States, criminal justice system, a justice system that deports people.
Well, word to the wise. Here's a little Gaffigan for you, a little comedy.
I'm constantly going through security, always behind that person that's never left their house before. They always want to ask me questions like, can I bring soup on the plane? It's homemade soup. I'm like, you should ask them. For an ID, can I use a fishing license? Should I take off my shoes and my pants? Yes, you should. Airport security is annoying. It's nothing compared to international travel, like going through customs and immigration. That's so intense. They're dressed like SWAT team members. I always get so nervous. I'm like, do I have heroin on me? I don't even know what heroin looks like, but I might have accidentally packed some. There's that mini interview with the customs agent. What do you plan to do in the country? Murder people. You got me. I wasn't ready for your trick question. I always feel like an idiot when I travel internationally. Some of it is I don't know the metric system. It's not like I wasn't exposed to it. When I was growing up, they're like, learn the metric system. Everyone learn the metric system. Big switch coming up. And then 10 years later, they're like, never mind. It's too hard. It's based on tens. Let's go buy an SUV. So now I can't ask a distance when I visit another country. I'm like, how far is that? They're like, that's 500 kilometers. I'm not in the Olympics. This isn't a James Bond film. What's it in normal speak? I don't speak any other languages. I have friends that speak Spanish and French and Portuguese. I don't care. I speak English, the language Jesus spoke. At least he did in the movie I watched. I always love doing that joke. There's always a couple of faces in the audience like, don't say that. Because you travel internationally, you realize some people don't like Americans. I mean, the Canadians like us, and the Israelis like us. The Australians like Americans so much, it makes you question their judgment. You should read some of our history. But I get a kick out of what Europeans don't like about Americans. So it's like, you Americans are dumb. You know nothing about Europe. It's not that we're dumb. We're just not that interested. Sorry, I don't want to learn more about your windmill country. He's going to get a wooden shoe in his ass. First time I did that joke, the whole front row was Dutch people. And they didn't care. They did. I don't know. They have no emotion. It doesn't matter. He's the most anti-Dutch comedian ever. Obviously, I love traveling internationally. The only negative, too many foreigners, right? The weird thing is you travel around the world, and you realize pretty quickly people are the same wherever you go. Wherever you go, there are good people, and there are Russians. See, the reason that's funny is because we were all raised with this bigotry towards Russians. I have a friend, he was born in Russia. He moved here when he was 3, and I still think he might be a spy. We don't know. The best is when you're visiting a country and someone thinks you're a native. I was waiting for a cab in Stockholm, and this Swedish lady turned to me, and she was like, Bjornborg, Bjornborg. That's not what she said. That's what I heard.